Good morning, everybody. So, since this is the last one, I'd like to also express my gratitude here at the beginning. I how grateful I am to have had the opportunity to be here with you, and really how truly honored I am. I really expected at this point there would be like 15 or 16 people left who were here just because they were being nice. And truly, you know, I've been amazed since the beginning at why they would trust me to come and do this at all. Can you imagine that at least one staff meeting since the beginning, they've kind of, some grown-up has said, are we sure this was a good idea? Should we let him keep doing this? Does he have to talk about erectile dysfunction at every class? Got it in one last time. No, everybody has been unfailingly thoughtful and considerate and supportive, you know, as we have sort of planned this time together. And I really am grateful and appreciate it very much. You know, the ideas that we started talking about all of this were based in what I believe makes a person be the way that they are determines how I treat them. It's not the facts of the situation, it's not the science of the situation that determines how I treat people, but it's what I really believe makes them be the way that they are. And so it turns out that facts are easy, but beliefs are hard, right? Because we choose to believe things about people, we choose to believe about things about what is going wrong with folks based on our own prejudices and our own biases. You know, but that doesn't mean that we don't end up knowing a lot about what goes wrong with folks. And that's because things have been going wrong for a very long time. So just a little bit of a history of how we figure out what to do, what's going wrong with people. You know, the reality is that if I feel pretty good and nothing is really hurting me or scaring me, in general, I don't seek out any kind of a healer at all, or a priest, or a shaman, or anybody else. You know, I just don't. If I'm going along and I'm pretty sporty and everything's going okay, I don't ask for help, right? So the reality is that I have to hurt enough or be scared enough, usually both, scared by the amount that I'm hurting, in order for me to seek out help from anybody. And that's really how we discover what's wrong with people and what to do about it. You know, throughout history, that's what's happened. And always along the way, there has to be patient number one. That is the first patient, the first client, the first somebody, human being, who's had this thing, whatever it is, go wrong with them, right? And when that guy presents himself and says, you know, here, doc, I've got this thing going on with me, the first thing that a healer of any kind says is, well, tell me about it. And what we're asking for now today, we call the signs and symptoms, right? What are the signs and symptoms of the thing that's going wrong with you? And that's when our patient reports to us what that is. Well, doc, it's this, that, and the other thing. This on Tuesday, not on Wednesdays, and my leg goes like this. And that's an unusual thing because this really is patient number one, remember? This is the first guy that's ever had that particular thing going wrong with him. Now, our healer, because he wants to help, tries to figure out what it is that's going wrong with this guy. And the first thing that he does is he consults with all the other healers. He consults with all the other people to find out if anybody else has ever heard of this, that, or the other thing. Right? He consults to see if somebody else knows what to do about it. In the end, he won't find anything in the literature, and he won't find anybody who knows about it. Why? Patient number one, right? But he still has to try to help, doesn't he? So he says, go and try this. Based on whatever experience, knowledge, and training that he has, he says, go and try this. And out the door goes patient number one. Now, amazingly, in the door comes patient number two and says, well, doc, I've got this, that, and the other thing. This on Tuesdays, not on Thursdays, and my leg goes like this. And that doc goes, that's amazing. Now, I just saw that, right? And now he's got some new information because the first patient died, right? And so in the worst case scenario, he knows one thing that either didn't help at all or maybe made it worse, right? And that's the worst case, isn't it? Is he has that bit of information. So probably if he's a pretty good healer, what he's gonna do is try something different, right? Let's try something new on this guy. Well, now since he's seen two patients in a row, he's become a specialist. Now he's a specialist in this, that, and the other thing, right? And he starts getting referrals from every place. And this, that, and the other thing, this on Tuesdays, not on Wednesdays, and my leg goes like this. He's the expert. He starts seeing them all over the place. When the 100th patient gets referred to him, what is the worst case scenario? 99 things that don't help at all, or maybe make it worse, right? That's the worst case practice, isn't it? Is I now know 99 things that do not seem to help at all. And that is good information to have. That's good information to have. Because I know 99 things that I probably don't need to try. Now look at the history of the treatment of the things that we call mental illness, right? We haven't always used that language. We haven't used alcoholism, drug addiction. We haven't used mental illness. We haven't used all the language that I've been using for the last 4 weeks. But the truth is, these things have been around for a very long time, right? And we've tried an awful lot of things to look at what makes it be that way and make it better. And you know what we've discovered? 999,000 things that don't work at all, right? And don't seem to make it better. We've discovered a lot of things that don't work. One of them, for instance, is that we've discovered that judging people for what's wrong with them doesn't seem to help. I mean, it really doesn't seem to help. And it's not because we haven't tried that, right? It's not because we haven't like made efforts in those areas. And I would be for it. I'd be for it if it made people better. I'm not against that sort of thing. I'm pretty good at judging people, and I'm willing to judge people. And if it helped, I would go for it, right? But it turns out that as far back as we can go, asking questions like whose fault it is doesn't seem to help, right? Who sinned, the father or the guy? Well, that's not even a good question. Let's just go help the guy, right? And in my business, that turns out to be true an awful lot. You know, asking sort of whose fault it is and who's to blame, did you do it to yourself or did it get done to you and stuff like that, not all that important questions, right? And we've ended up finding out, of course, over time, some things that actually do make it better. I mean, with all the cases that we've had and everything that's been tried, you would think that we would stumble across a thing or two that would make it better, right? I mean, just by luck, you're bound to find some things that actually make it better, and that's probably true. Fortunately, have done that by the kind of experimentation that is both the best for science and the worst for the patient. Because these are people who we've pretty much been able to do anything to them we wanted to, right? I mean, the truth is that this is a patient population that, for the most part, we can run any kind of experiment that we like. Cutting different parts of the brain out and tying up and tying down and whipping and beating and all the things, certainly shaming and judging. You know, all of these things we have tried, and we've tried it so much, and we've run so much field research on it, we know that it does not work, and that some things do. So let me tell you some things that we know just about that, what the history of mental health and the history of mental health treatment tells us. One is that most people get better. Most people get better. And see, that's always a surprise. When people look at me and I say that, that's always a shock. It's like, what do you mean? I said, well, really, through a series of things, through some odd circumstance, and then sometimes through intent and some things we do, but the most people actually go through what they have to go through and get better. And I want you to know that because of that bias we talked about on the first day. I don't like to see things that I don't think are going to get better, right? And so I want you to know that most of the stuff that I deal with for a living, most of the time, people get better. And not only that, most of it we can be helpful at. And most of it, people in my business are pretty helpful at. We have a terrible reputation, partially because of that experimentation, partially for other reasons that are too long to list right now. But the truth is that all of the research shows that people that struggle is that most of us will have something that goes on with us during the course of our lifetime that you could call mental illness, and most of us will get better from it. And see, that's really good information to know. It's also important for you to know that the one factor that we think has ended up being the most profound is the relationship between the helper and the person who is being helped. You know, we've experimented with all kinds of technique and all kinds of things that make a difference in people's life. And the one consistent factor has been the relationship between the person who is trying to help and the person who is being helped. And that really shouldn't surprise us all that much. In my business, it turns out that the therapist and the way that he relates with the person is extremely important. Who would have guessed, right? Apparently, Crocodile Dundee. Because in that old movie, when his girlfriend or fiance was trying to explain psychotherapy to him and the benefit that she got from it, his response was, "Ain't you got no mates?" You know, sort of the idea being if you had somebody to talk to, you know, maybe you wouldn't need to go to psychotherapy. And you know, sometimes people say that to me. They say, "Steve, you know, I'm just paying you $100 an hour to be my friend." And I said, "Well, you know, I can understand why you say that. I'd like to believe that there's a little bit more to the relationship than that. There's some things that we're actually bringing to the table beyond just that." But I'll tell you, the ability to talk to people in that way, and to talk to people openly in that way, strong and powerful. One of the things that I bring to the table, that people like me in my business bring to the table, is I'm going to be right there, right? I'm going to be right there, I'm going to be extremely present, and I'm going to be listening to everything that you have to say, and I'm interested in it, right? And that turns out to be a relatively rare commodity. So much so that we can charge people for it. One of the things that I have said to me, it's an interesting thing to hear from people. But I have people who tell me when I'm speaking to them in my office that they're spiritual but not religious. Have you ever heard that? I think I know what they mean. Sometimes I ask to try to get them to explain it to me. Mostly when they say that, they wind up telling me stuff that they don't like about church, you know, and churches and church people. So they haven't really given up on God particularly, but they've given up on this, right, is sort of their thinking about it. Now, there's more to it than that, probably, but I'm always interested in that. So it brings me to a little bit of a conversation about spirituality and the way that it works in my business. It's one of the areas of my business that science has moved us away from, but if you read everything about where my business, psychotherapy, came from, spirituality was a big part of it for a long time, and a lot of us believe that it should still be a part of it now. Right, so I'm going to try, using the talent that I have for major oversimplification, to talk about the difference between that, spirituality and religion, for a minute. Right? So what I think that spirituality is an active relationship with a power greater than self that brings meaning and purpose to my life. So I think spirituality is an active relationship with power greater than self that brings meaning and purpose to my life. And what I think religion is instructions on what the type, kind, and quality of that relationship should be. Now, that's a major oversimplification. There are people in this room who know much more about these subjects. That's one of the nice things about being Episcopalian, is there's always somebody who knows more. You know? But still, go with me for a second on the oversimplification, right? So spirituality, then, is an active relationship with a power greater than self that brings meaning and purpose to my life. And so when I do that, I'm going to do a little English lesson now. There are two clauses in that sentence that are set off by commas. You can hear them when I say it. Spirituality is an active relationship, comma, with a power greater than self. That says who the relationship is with, right? Comma, that brings meaning and purpose to my life. That points back to and says what does the relationship do? Those are just clauses set off by commas that are descriptive of the main part of the sentence, right? What that means is that I can put a period on the end of that first section of the sentence and still have a whole complete sentence, right? Spirituality is an active relationship. I take the other two clauses away for a second and I've still got a whole complete sentence. Then it turns out that active is also a descriptive word, describes the type of relationship, right? That just means I can take it away and still have a whole complete sentence, and what I end up with is spirituality is a relationship. Now see, that gives me a way to think about things. Because see, I can talk about relationships some. I can talk about type, kind, and quality of relationships. I can talk about relationships in a way that makes sense to me, in a way that sometimes everything that's religious does not. So just go with me for a second that I've argued that spirituality is a relationship, and let me talk about relationships. Let's imagine a relationship scale that goes like this. On this end of the relationship scale, I have sort of the lowest level of relationship. And on that end of the relationship scale, I have sort of the highest level of relationship. On this end of the relationship, I have a person that I see walking down the street. I've never met them before. They've never met me. And as we pass, he nods at me and I nod at him. We can now be said to have a nodding acquaintance, right? That's a fairly low level of relationship, right? On this end of the relationship scale, what I have is a person who knows me and who knows my heart, who I can be transparent with, I can be myself with this person. We call this level of relationship intimate, right? We call this level of relationship intimacy. So the highest level of relationship now we're going to call is an intimate relationship. And we're going to say that all other relationships fall in between the nodding acquaintance and the intimate relationship on the scale of intensity, if you will, or the type, kind, and quality of the relationship. Are you with me so far? Now I can think in terms of, well, how can I improve a relationship? How can I improve the relationship? If I want to go from a nodding acquaintance to a higher level of relationship, what should I do? Well, I could speak to a person, right? I could get some information from the person, or I could give some information to the person, right? But I could increase the amount of information between us. Isn't that true? Now, what if I stand on this end and ignore my nodding acquaintance, but engage in an argument with somebody about, I wonder if that person has written any books. Are they one in three persons? You know, are they, I mean, what if I engage in an argument about where they live and what they want from me? Does that improve my relationship with the person? No, it might improve my relationship with the person I'm having the argument with, but it's not gonna improve the relationship over here, right? The way that I can improve relationship is by disclosing myself to the person. I don't have any control over whether or not they disclose themselves to me. I only have whether or not I disclose myself to them. So in order for me to improve relationship, what I have to do is have a willingness for you to know me. That's the part that I can control. I have to have a willingness to open my heart. We call it into me, you see. Intimacy, right? I have to have the ability to share my heart with you. And it's the one thing that I can control in a relationship. You know, when we talk about these in terms of improving relationship, here's the model that we use. What we say is that there's three kinds of relationships that are available in the world today. There's my relationship with God, power greater than self. There's my relationship with myself. And then there's my relationship with you, 1, 2, and 3. And that those three things describe all the relationship that is available in the world today, God, self, and others, right? And then we start doing funny things. We start sort of dividing those up, don't we? And we say, you gotta love yourself before you can love other people, right? You gotta know that God loves you. So we start dividing these things up and describing them somehow as if they're different relationships. And that's confusing to me. It's confusing to me because after all, don't I only have actually one capacity for intimacy and love? Now it might change depending on who I'm with, but isn't in the relationship, don't I have only one thing that I can control, and that's how open my heart is to you. How open my heart is to you. I don't really have anything else that I can do. I have the ability to be more intimate with you, but not necessarily to control whether or not you are with me. Look at this in this terms of the relationship with God stuff, okay? I gotta tell you, my relationship with God is difficult because I'm not really clear when I'm getting feedback from God. I'm reasonably sure that I am getting it, but I'm extraordinarily unclear on when it's happening, you know? And I'm not sure I would know it if I saw it. I used to tell people, I need a burning bush, you know, with a voice coming out, but I'm not sure I wouldn't run up with a fire extinguisher, you know, and say, keep it down, I'm trying to figure out what the meaning of my life is. I mean, even if it happened, I think I would miss it. So I do sort of this retroactive analysis of God's will. I know y'all probably don't do this, but I do this, right? It's like, if things turn out good, I go, God's will. If things turn out bad, I go, must not have been. So I use hindsight to evaluate what God's will is, which gives me almost no insight into what I'm supposed to be doing going forward, right? That's what I end up doing. Because I'm really not too sure when God is speaking to me, although I'm confident that it probably is happening. I'm really not too sure exactly when I hear it. So I find that intimacy in that relationship is a little bit difficult for me to practice because I feel unsure. And then there's my relationship with myself. Now, boy, that one's confusing. I mean, you want to talk about a difficult relationship? Here, try this experiment. Do not do it in the church bathroom. Go home and look in the mirror and look yourself in the eye and say, I love you. Look yourself in the eye and say, I love you. Number one, just the experience of looking yourself in the eye is often entertaining. But then when you start talking to yourself and saying, I love you, because, I mean, that's what we're to do. And it's really hard to do. In my business, we teach all these self-esteem building exercises. We teach all these positive things that you should say to me, to say to yourself, you know, so that you can build yourself up. So I'm good enough. I'm smart enough. Doggone it, people love me. I'm supposed to, you know, I'm supposed to say things, you know, to myself. But you know, I got to tell you, that's really, really hard to do. I mean, let me just ask you a simple question here. If you talked to me the way you talk to yourself, would you have a friend or an enemy? You know, I can tell you on me, some days it's like the ride home is tough. You know, I get in the car, turn up the radio real loud so I can't hear anything that you've got to say, right? If I do bother to talk to you, it's yelling about somebody in the car in front of me. Yeah. And then when I get home, I talk to myself for sure. Well, you really messed that up. You didn't do a good job on that today, and you're getting fat. And for some reason, I'm not feeling good about myself. I can't really figure out why that's happening. And I got to tell you, positive affirmations have been extraordinarily difficult for me to overcome all of that because that voice is persistent and loud and consistent. You know, the things that happen up in there happen seemingly without me wanting them to. Right? So it turns out that in my relationship with you is the place that I get to practice with immediate feedback. You know, it's in my relationship with you that I get to see exactly what it is that it feels like to be in love and to be loved. It's the place that I actually get to experience this happening, right? It's the thing that we call fellowship, right? Being with one another. And so, as it turns out, though, what's interesting is that if I can get better at loving you, I get better at loving myself and loving God because there's only one capacity to do that, mine, right? I can't control how much God loves me. I have some beliefs about that, but I don't have any control over it. I can't control how much you love me. I have some beliefs about it, but I don't have any control over it. But I can control how much I love you and how intimate I am with you. And if I can increase that capacity, if I increase that capacity, then it changes all of those relationships. It changes all of those relationships. I believe it is why we are told to love one another. Now, this is the part where I'm going to like venture off into stuff where there's plenty of people who know more than me, right? But because of my religious background and lack of Bible exposition and contextual training, I am able to pull verses out at random and just paraphrase them and make them mean whatever I want to. Let's imagine for a second that there's a powerful boss, a big CEO, right? To the extent that this boss has control of his company and control of his people, what he says goes, right? When if he says there's going to be no conflict, there's no conflict. No fighting, no fighting. Going to be teamwork, there's teamwork, right? Imagine a CEO who is powerful enough to actually say that and it is always true and it always happens. I have a hard time imagining omnipotence, don't you? But imagine that somebody is powerful enough that when they say this is true, then it is. And there's not anything else, right? So whenever I've been heard, love your neighbor as yourself, I've always heard that as a good recommendation, haven't you? And so what? Here's what I do. I put the words "you should" in front of it, but you're not very good at it. That's what I get. You should love your neighbor as yourself. It's a good idea. Now, that's not a very strong CEO, is it? What if it's an equation? Not a "you should," it's an equation. Love your neighbor as yourself. You will. You do love your neighbor as yourself. In fact, my capacity to experience love of myself is absolutely limited by my capacity to experience love of you, love from you. That's it. That's it. Judge not, lest you be judged. What if that's an equation? That the exact amount of judgment that I feel for myself is the exact amount of judgment that I give you. What if it's a perfect equation? What if the reason that I should not judge you is because I will then be burdened by the judgment? You know, in my business, we say all the time that if you've got one finger pointed at somebody, you've got three finger pointed back at you. And the things that you see in somebody else that cause you the most problems are the things that are in yourself that you're having a hard time. We say all of these things and we know that they're true. What if these are principles? That the business of loving you and having compassion for you is exactly the work that I am supposed to be doing. And that we can extend this to all areas, but especially to the areas of people who are suffering. Suffering with mental health issues, suffering with substance abuse and alcoholism, with people who are suffering. That it doesn't do any good for us to judge why or what, but what if our job is just to love them and not to judge them? Maybe that's the thing people in my business are able to give. Maybe it is. You know, I gotta tell you, people, especially in the choir who know me, I'm not holding myself up as like an example of all of this. I absolutely am not. I'm not a paragon of intimacy and or love. I'm not even easy to know, much less be close to. And I promise you that that is true. But just to make sure that you know that it's true, I'm going to tell you one last story. A few years ago, there's a recovery ministry in the Diocese of Alabama. Recovery ministry. And one of the things that they do is they put on a weekend up at Camp McDowell. A weekend for people. It's really a nifty thing. I've been several times. And some years ago, I was invited to come and do the whole weekend. And it was called Relationships in Recovery. And it was all about how to do this intimacy thing. You know, from beginning to end, it was how to do this intimacy thing. Now, the way that this works is Pam does all the work and I stand up and talk. A lot like this is going. All right? And so she had come up with a lot of really nifty things for me to do and I had been working on it. But the niftiest thing was the thing at the end, where we had these little ceramic hearts to give out at the end. We had one for everybody. And she, I'm pretty sure it was her, had come up with this little thing, into me you see, right? And into you I see. And on the outside it had that, you know, into me you see. And then when you open up on the inside, yeah, oh, it was great. It was great, right? And so the idea was that at the end of it, what we were gonna do is just a little bit of a ceremony, right? Where we would start and we would just take those and we would pass them out and then you could pass it on. And all you had to do is go up and look the person in the eye and offer them your heart, right? And then when they opened it, they would see the intimacy thing. Oh, I thought, you know, this thing is gonna be great. And so I'm doing my thing. The weekend has gone pretty well. Most people were couples, it wasn't all couples. It was a pretty mixed crowd. But there was one guy that was sitting on the front row, and he was by himself, clearly by himself. And he was a lumpy, you know, in my opinion. Now, my daughter, who was much younger than Shauna, she was the only kid that was there, because we take her everywhere. So she was there, and Pam was, like, maintaining order and keeping me on track and all that kind of stuff while I'm talking. So Pam and Shauna were over here, and Shauna was doing her thing, you know. Twirling around, you know, she was doing what she does, you know, because she was a kid. And I want to do the quiet down thing, but Pam's a much better parent than I am, so she's like letting her, you know, be a kid. And it's bothering this guy. And I can see that it's bothering this guy. I mean, I'm not, I mean, he's huffing. and glaring at her. You know, he's glaring at her and it's bothering me, you know? And so the first night it kind of bothered me. By the second day I was mad. And so I started preaching at him, you know. Gotta love big love. I'm giving it a pretty good push too, you know. And you wouldn't believe all the dark thoughts that go on in my head, you know, about why are you here? Or maybe you should go. Why don't you sit on the back row? All the stuff that comes into my mind. But I'm continuing to preach love and intimacy to the bride. Doing my very best there. And of course, Shauna hadn't gotten to do anything. She was just having to be good, except for Pam had told her she was going to get to do the thing, right? She was going to get to help pass out the hearts, you know? So as I'm doing the big wrap-up, you know, Shauna's over there. She's ready. You know, she's ready. She got the heart. Pam's like holding on to the back of her shirt. You know, she got the heart, right? And so I'm explaining the ceremony and what's about to happen and all this kind of stuff. And Pam cuts her loose. And you know what she did? I mean, she heads straight for the guy. I mean, very first thing, she heads straight for the guy. I couldn't believe it. And he just melted, and I just melted. You know? Why did she do that? Because she hadn't got any enemies. You know? Love your enemies is not a good idea. It's not a suggestion. It's that we can't have any enemies. Yeah, we are one body. We are one body. Can't hate him without hating some part of myself. I cannot. And it just broke my heart. And it also shows how many times I harden my heart. You know, I make this commitment that I'm going to be soft and authentic and transparent, and I'm going to be that way. And then something like this happens, and it's the only way I know that I have hardened my heart yet again. Because I think it will keep me safe. I think somehow or another, it won't happen to me, or you won't hurt me, or I won't feel your pain if I can protect myself and protect my heart. But it's not true. It's not true, right? Instead, what I have to do is be willing to love and also be willing to hurt. I know that this is true. I know it's especially true in this area of mental health. Now, these are people that we can just too easily judge. And what it's caused us to do in the church is it's caused us to make them be quiet. You know, it's caused us to not be willing to say, I'm depressed, I'm anxious, I'm struggling, I don't know what to do. Right? And I think that we can change that. Another thing that people come in and say to me in my office, since this is Birmingham, Alabama, is they'll say, are you a Christian? Now, I got to tell you, that's a complex question to me. I think I know what they're asking me. I make some assumptions about what they're asking me when they say that. And so usually I just say, I am. And just let them assume whatever that means, you know, by that, and we just go right on, right? Because to me, it's a little like asking, are you a Christian dentist? You know, it's like, yeah, but I'm a good dentist. You know, so, I understand. Right, I understand. So most of the time, I don't give very complex answers unless the person presses me and really asks me about it. But on one particular day, there was this lady, I don't know, she must have caught me wrong or something like that, and she asked me the question, and I answered honestly. I said, yes, but. You know, we probably have some major disagreements about doctrine and theology, you know, because I really do believe we have minds to think, you know, and I really do believe we have hearts to love and hands to serve, and I really do believe that it's okay for us to disagree about things and that we can go on and still be Christian in one body. And she said, Episcopalian. So I've ended up loving being Episcopalian. You know, and the truth is that maybe by the tolerance that we have in that way, a unique opportunity to have tolerance in this way in the areas of alcoholism, drug addiction, mental health, and the other things that people suffer with. maybe we have a unique opportunity. And I really do hope that that is true. You've been very gracious to me. Thanks a lot. Russell said I have 4 minutes for questions and possible answers. Yes, sir. Right. The question is, since I mentioned spirituality, how do I incorporate that into the healing activity? In the end, since I do believe that it's all about, relationship, as quickly as I can, I try to find out where the fear and pain is to be in relationship with God, self, and others. And so that's almost always the background of what I'm working on. It's more about like what a person thinks and believes about being loved and their ability to love that matters to me. Most people that I deal with have a hard time believing that they are loved. And so that's the point that I work on it at. I don't try to convince anybody of any particular thing. I'm certainly not qualified to, for any particular theology or doctrine, so I don't do that. I go with whatever theirs is. But I'm interested in uncovering what the blocks are to being loved. Other questions? The question is, do I always suggest that people go to 12-step programs? Almost always. Almost always. It's a relatively rare person, depending on their circumstance, that I might not do that. I'm certainly willing to work with people at any level that they are. It's not a requirement in order to be able to work with me, but the answer is usually, I do. Yes. September 26th, 27th, and 28th at Camp McDowell this year, and they can get more information. Catholic Grand Diocese. It's usually a really wonderful weekend, and I'm a big fan. Well, not coherently, but I'm willing to tell you. It feels like a test, man. Well, which thing? Absolutely. I am. And you did very well. And you did very well. She's referencing Dr. Jung and his belief in the need for total psychic change, a spiritual change, which I'm a true believer in. And science is showing us that this idea that I can be created a new heart and be a new man is actually true. As we discover more and more about neuroplasticity and the expression of genes and stuff like that, it's just fascinating to me how we're finding out that creating me a clean heart award is actually, that's for real. I can be a new man. I can be a different kind of a person. And I'm strongly encouraged by that, even though I'm not doing it very well. Thank you very much. I really appreciate it.